be Alex Chen, one of the oldest players in the martial arts studies community, and he's also doing a lecture about consent, but he's more interested in the dynamics and the processes, how to deal, how to create consent.
Okay, thank you, Martin. Hi, everyone. I apologize for a very slight deviation from what was advertised in terms of the abstract that I sent in, the title. I presented a very, very similar piece just 2 weeks ago in a conference that quite a few people were at, so I thought, you know, I'd probably better change and sharpen this up and change the focus very slightly. So I was planning to present sort of general overview of the work on consent as a concept in the combat sport setting, and I will talk about that very briefly, but I'm applying it a bit more closely here to look at the work of some very interesting individuals that I did a piece of research with a couple of years ago, which are the proverbial men in the middle in our full contact fighting of mixed martial arts. So we'll be looking at how the referee plays a role in mediating consent to do physically injurious actions, let's say, in the context of combat sports. So just a little bit about consent to start off with. If anyone is interested in chasing this up in terms of the more general ideas, then the paper that I've presented a couple of times and that is out there, it's all open access in the International Review for Sociology of Sport, Communicated Consent and Sport, a Typological Model by myself and Chris Matthews. So please do go ahead and grab yourselves a copy of that if you want to read the sort of general underlying position I'm starting from here. So consent, as we probably all know, is a very important moral construct in everyday life. It basically provides us with a mechanism for giving people moral authority to do things with and to us that shouldn't be taken for granted as given. So consent is a very important facet of living in a society, living with other people, doing things with other people in a very broad sense. In the context of sport, the reason that people aren't arrested for punching each other in the boxing ring or tackling each other on the rugby field is the principle of consent, and that is in UK case law, that's very well established. Consent is a legal underpinning for enabling sport to happen. It's quite... Is there an echo in here? Is it the microphone? It's the mic, is it?
The mic might be... It's the sound from the other room.
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, excellent. Okay, it's a strange boom that I was getting every time I spoke. Anyway, so consent is important. With that in mind, it is quite strange to see that in my home discipline, my field, sociology of sport, consent has not really been looked at as a phenomenon, as a social process, as an object of study. It's been alluded to an awful lot in the field, quite often when researchers are talking about other things, like violence or drug use, or particularly sort of the kind of coach-athlete relationships that Stacey was talking about. Sexual abuse in sports, consent is mentioned then, but it's only really mentioned in context where it's missing, where it's broken down. So what I wanted to do, or myself and Chris wanted to do, is look at how consent is done normally. So when consent isn't necessarily missing, how is it actually constructed? How do I know that the person I'm boxing with consents to me punching them in the face? What processes, methods do we use to construct and communicate that? So that's basically what this paper is about, folks. It's a typology to look at different ways that people communicate consent. What we ended up doing is this four-point typology here. We've got the overt communication of consent, where we literally say, yes, I'm okay with being kicked, or we sign a waiver, for instance, at a competition, you know, I indemnify the organizer against injury, all that kind of thing. We might have conversations with our training partners, the coach might, you know, engage in that sort of thing. Overt communication. Then we have subtle communication, and what we mean by that is things that are not necessarily verbalised but are understood. It's a nice little concept, the conventionally recognised gesture. So if anyone boxes, you know, at the start of the match, people touch gloves. You know, if we're doing jiu-jitsu, we do the little slap and the bump. It's a little symbol that we share that we use to communicate that we're ready to begin training or competing and so on. We also have other mechanisms where perhaps it's not as overtly communicative, it's not necessarily a two-way communication, but I'm able to read my partner's body language. Folks, you've read around the notion of intensity negotiation in boxing. Louis Racon, I think, is quite famous for writing about this. A few other researchers have described this sort of social logic of sparring, where if my partner's being a bit slower than normal, I'll read that and I'll go, okay, you know, I'm going to slow it down. Again, Stacey was describing a similar dynamic earlier about upping the levels of intensity and matching each other. This crosses over quite nicely into assumed consent, and generally when I talk to people about the issue of consent in sports, the main reaction that comes up is, well, you know, if you're there, that's your consent, right? You've stepped into the ring, you've stepped onto the rugby field, obviously you're okay with being tackled and punched. That's written into the norms and the cultural expectations of the sport. The institutional structure, which I'll talk a little bit more about later today, gives us this kind of framework that we can say, well, I know the rules, I presume that you also know the rules, we're both here, presumably, you know, we're going to assume this, to fight according to the rules. So we don't have to have any kind of conversation, we don't even really need to touch gloves. And most of the time at the start of a fight, the touch of gloves is not really an act of communicating consent anyway. It's part of the ritual, or it's something that fighters will forego in order to build up the hype and the tension or something. So the assumption of consent, if you're there, then you've consented. That's it. What I want to talk about specifically, though, is a very interesting phenomenon that I think we all need to pay quite close attention to when we're thinking about things to do with safeguarding, when we're thinking about the duty of care that professionals in sports contexts have for athletes, and that's the deferral of consent. And that's why I put this just one. I'm not going to talk about this particular example, but just one example of the role of the corner team in this sense. The coaches who go with a fighter and sit in their corner or on their side or whatever, what have you, are now part of their team and part of their camp. These are characters who at various stages will have consent deferred to them. So we've probably all seen in boxing when a boxer is losing quite badly and the referee is allowing the match to go on, the corner team might throw the towel in. They're withdrawing consent on behalf of the athlete. The athlete doesn't want to, certainly not in combat sports, they don't want to say, hold on a minute, you know, I think I'm done. No, time out, I've had enough. That's not the cultural norms of the sport. That's would be frowned upon, right? That would be seen perhaps as a sign of poor moral fortitude. So I'm not necessarily going to throw the towel in myself because I know that my coach will do it for me. And it's a way of perhaps saving face, maybe. Or I'm so wrapped up in the moment and I'm not thinking about things. Maybe I've taken too many shots to the head to have any kind of rational clarity. And so that ability to withdraw consent rests with the coach, who retains capacity to make those decisions when I'm losing. So the deferral of consent is when people in sports allow others to make decisions for them about what they will or won't do in the context of training or competing. In this paper, we give a few examples, mostly focusing on the role of the coach and the referee. And today, I'm going to talk about the referee. So that's a brief overview of sport and consent. So the men in the middle. Again, I have a paper to flag if anyone wants to read. This should also be open access in the Qualitative Research in Sport, Exercise and Health Journal on generally the role of referees, and not about consent per se, but about what referees do in terms of managing risk. Quick overview. I interviewed seven referees, most of whom, six of them, had worked at the very highest levels of the sport internationally. One of them was more of a kind of regional guy. But they all worked lower level stuff as well. So they were very experienced referees. They're often, almost always, in fact, former or current fighters themselves. So they have a very strong embedded connection to the sport. They follow the sport's logic. They, in many ways, embody the sport's logic. When I interviewed them, they often spoke about loving the sport. That word came up quite often. You know, I wanted to give back. I love this sport. And I wanted to be part of it by, you know, taking it to the next level and so on when I finish my career. A lot of them, aside from those who are, you know, at the very top, most of them do this as a second job, so they also have full-time profession elsewhere. It's kind of a hobby kind of work. They don't get a lot of money for it, but they do it for the love. Interestingly, a lot of the veteran referees, so those who've been around for more than 10 years, started the work by accident. The route into the job was described to me by one of the UFC's top referees as he showed up to fight but was injured, so he wasn't medically cleared to fight. The referee was stuck in traffic, so the organiser said, well, why don't you referee instead? You're here, you know the rules, hopefully you can referee. And it was simple as that, and this is how, you know, a lot of these guys got started, so very informally. They do now have training programmes available. I went to a seminar. I'm actually a qualified MMA judge after going to that seminar, which is very cool. And just yesterday I got an invite to go and judge a show. Nah, I don't think so. You don't want me in that corner. So the training is available, but yeah, if someone like me can just rock up and be qualified, it shows you something about, you know, the qualification that we're getting here. It's not very formal, and there's no requirement. As Stacey mentioned briefly, there's not an overarching governance structure for these sports in the UK. There isn't some other countries, but it's still very loosely regulated here. So really, there's no controls over who these people are and what they're doing. That said, this point I think is really worth labouring. Below the top level, the bright lights and the big money, mixed martial arts takes place around this country pretty much every weekend, lower level shows. These are often organised by passionate enthusiasts who have a little bit of money and they've got some connections and they put a show together. They're not necessarily run by very, very slick, well-trained professional teams. Often the referee will be the most knowledgeable person in that space. They will have been to more shows, people will have seen them on television, they'll be highly respected. The referee starts to take on much more duty than just being the man in the middle, so to speak, in the cage. And I do say man, I know that's a gendered term. By and large, the referees in mixed martial arts are almost always men. There are some women doing it, but it is a very male occupation. So yeah, the referee often assumes multiple overlapping responsibilities, which if we've got time, I'll elaborate on that a little bit later. So the referee's work obviously comes with quite a hefty burden of responsibility. The referee is responsible for making sure that fights happen smoothly. They are the arbiter of MMA action, as the point says. They make fights happen. But also, they are very much responsible for the athlete's well-being. And as you can imagine, those two things do not always marry up very nicely. Sometimes the things that are happening in full contact fights are not good for people's health. And so if you feel that your primary purpose, as many of them describe to me, is to protect athletes, but also your primary purpose, your other primary purpose is to make fights happen, there's a tension there. And a lot of the referees, again, if you want to read that paper, I've got some nice chunks of data excerpts that I didn't want to clutter my slides with, where they're describing the sort of awkward, tense negotiation of whether or not they should intervene and stop the fight. As I've put on the slide, I'm just going to bring all these points up. The referee becomes sort of an embodiment of the institution of the sport. The referee is there as a person that signifies to everybody else that this is a genuine athletic contest and not simply a brawl between two people who want to hurt each other. The referee makes sure that they abide by the rules. The referee starts and stops the contest. The referee becomes this sort of entity that makes the fight happen as an MMA match rather than any other kind of fight. The referee, therefore, is both a tangible, real person, but also a symbolic representation of the institution of the sport. Stacey mentioned Jill Weinberg's research around the stuff she did on consent in mixed martial arts, and this comes through very well in her book about the importance of the institution of the sport for constructing a context within which consent can take place. So the referee, the third point there, becomes a tangible manifestation of the athlete's assumed consent. By being present and by mediating and by running the sport, they demonstrate to both the athletes that this is a consensual encounter. The way in which they do that is by making the stoppage decision at the point where they've deemed the genuine MMA action to be over and what they describe to me as excessive, unnecessary harm or violence from taking place. So the referee is responsible for ending a fight when it's no longer legitimate MMA action, where the fight has reached its logical, natural conclusion. Because of this, the referee is a person to whom consent is deferred. Quite a few of the referees that I spoke to described the fact that they knew that a fighter was done, and they could see that the fighter was waiting for them to finish the fight on their behalf. I spoke to a few fighters on the side of this research project. This was a larger project about medical care in the sport, risk management and so on. And athletes often confirm this sort of thing. Actually, when you're getting badly beaten, you don't want to tap to strikes in particular. Tapping out to strikes is considered to be perhaps a sign of weakness, maybe a lack of dedication in some quarters. So if you're getting swarmed, if someone's landing lots of shots, you just cover up and you wait for the referee. You don't visibly withdraw your consent, even though the sport provides mechanisms for you to do so. You defer that authority to somebody else. Now, this is generally fine, he says with bated breath, generally fine in so much as the referees are experienced and knowledgeable and they understand the sport, but obviously, as we know, referees are only human and they make mistakes. They let things go on too far. Sometimes perhaps they might finish things too early and they catch an awful lot of heat for that on social media when they've assumed the moral responsibility to take away someone's decision to continue doing a thing that it constitutes their career. You know, you've you've stolen the fight from me, you've taken the fight away from me by stopping it too early. So their exercise of that power can have repercussions for them. Am I okay for time, Martin? Fine, okay. Yes, and obviously when they do make those mistakes, they get an awful lot of heat for it, as I've mentioned. And sometimes, of course, fighters who've been maybe knocked around a little bit and not really sure where they are continue to fight and attack the referee. Sometimes fighters attack the referee because they're angry that they got stopped. This is, you know, it's good fodder for YouTube channels, but also if you think about the work of the referee, this is a person who's not making a lot of money, someone who's doing it for the love, you know, this is, can be quite a thankless task sometimes. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. The idea of being responsible for making decisions on other people's behalf about how much brain damage to allow them to absorb, about you know, at what point are you no longer, is it no longer in your best interest to continue fighting, is a massive responsibility. Another quick anecdote to share on this in respect to the burden of responsibility that referees have. One of the fights that I went to when I was shadowing medical staff, it was a mixed event. This is quite common in the UK. Mixed kickboxing, MMA, they even had a jiu-jitsu match in the cage, which the crowd didn't really like. There was a lot of whistling for that one. But the referees were from ISKS, they're an international sport karate association. They're kickboxing referees. Very good at striking martial arts. They didn't really know jiu-jitsu. And an MMA fight was going on. It was an amateur MMA fight, which has different rule sets to pro MMA. They were allowing illegal strikes that weren't legal under the amateur rules. But there were also, one moment that really stuck out was a fighter was caught in a triangle choke, and it's not a pleasant thing to be caught in, but it's not going to hurt too badly if you get choked unconscious. You know, it's not going to do you a great amount of damage as long as they let go, right? When you're out, as long as they let go. And of course the referee is there, you know, standing, watching. But the referee was watching the other fighter's hand for the tap, wasn't watching his face. And this guy's out, he's unconscious. And everybody around the cage, he's out. But the referee, of course, is well-trained to ignore the crowd, so just continues to stare. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And the other fighter actually popped his gum shoulder. I think he's out. And then at that point, the referee stopped it. So he'd gone for about 10, 15 seconds being held in a choke while unconscious. Now, why this is really interesting. Those of you who've read my work before, and you'll know the whole stuff, and me and Kyle have been arguing about this on Facebook, about what is violence in sport and so on. Consent is really, really important. For me as an athlete, if I'm going to fight somebody and you know, choke them and so on, if they've consented to doing this thing, then I don't feel as though I am doing anything wrong. I don't feel as though it's violence. If athletes have deferred consent to somebody else, they've put that authority, that moral authority, in somebody else's hands, and I'm continuing to then act towards them in a what would be violent manner, past the point at which that person wants their consent to be withdrawn, then it changes the moral meaning, and it changes, of course, the experience of doing it from one of being mutually constructive, supportive combat into something that's damaging and violent. So the referee has to get this right, because they're assuming responsibility for something that is central to the sport's ethical universe. I don't know if I'm explaining that clearly enough, but hopefully it's getting through. So referees obviously make errors. There are, I mentioned a couple of those. There's tons of research. That's not all mine. There's tons of research on the epidemiology of MMA, particularly around brain trauma and boxing. Of course, we've known this for a long time. These are damaging things. If we're giving consent to do these sports and to run these risks, and we're placing our ability to withdraw consent in the hands of the institutions that run those sports, they have a legal duty of care to make those decisions correctly. There is actually a couple of cases in UK case law of referees being successfully held accountable, held liable for injuries sustained in sport when they haven't upheld the rules. I think they're both from rugby, the two cases I'm aware of. So referees actually do have a legal duty of care to get this right. In terms of the implications for referees' work, obviously, you know, they can face negative repercussions if they get things wrong, or if they are perceived to have got things wrong, let's put it nice and clearly. They probably get more abuse for stopping things early than they do for stopping things late, which again speaks to the culture of the sport and perhaps some of the blasé attitudes that many fans have towards risk to athletes' health. Referees assume a massive psychological burden in doing this work. That came through quite clearly in some of the interviews that I did, where there's this generalised belief among MMA people that it's only a matter of time before somebody dies in the UK. It's only a matter of time before somebody dies in a show that I work. You know, God forbid, and so on. I'm always on my game to make sure it doesn't happen, but I know it might happen, and I would be responsible. A paper that I've got currently under review in martial arts studies is looking at the role that sports psychologists can play in supporting referees, given this kind of stuff is part of their bread and butter. So some of the implications there, you know, what can we do as academics, as people who are interested in the morality of sport, interested in safeguarding practices, interested in the political economy of sport, how can we work to support characters like referees to get these decisions, to manage these responsibilities well, to manage the responsibilities that they have, given consent has been deferred to them, to make sure that the sports run appropriately. Sorry, I skipped that, didn't pick it up, but there we go. That's